I saw a reason in here.
Thank you. I've only got a couple of questions. In paragraph 36 of your evidence where you talk about the guidance, can anybody work out what you should be buying, doing this by way of offsetting for biodiversity? Would you need to be a specialist to be able to understand that?
Usually by ecologists to design an offset, and that would typically be expected that would be the same ecologist that would be doing the site assessment or the AEE if that's required.
In terms of some of the examples you mentioned earlier, give you an idea of what any of those cost in terms of having to design the offset? Or
I have no information on those costs. I mean, costs will vary. It's like a side ship that would briefly ask someone about the gentleman before we came on about what it would cost to do a side system. And it varies on the size of the site and the nature and scale of the impacts and of the biodiversity that's present. But in line with my comment before regarding balancing the data requirements, I think that the cost would also scale with the data requirements as they are commensurate with the complexity and importance of that biodiversity. And I don't think that's an unreasonable thing when important decisions are being made that allow for the loss of biodiversity.
If you had two ecologists undertaking the assessment and working out what the biodiversity would be, is it likely or unlikely that they'd come up with the same answer?
I think
I'm directing it more to the guidance and how you do it rather than personalities.
Yeah, I think if they followed the guidance, I'd like to emphasise the guidance, not prescription, and they have been objective and resource similarly, then they should come up with very similar answers. But ecology is one of those disciplines where biological variation is always high, so you would expect some difference in those outcomes just by virtue of the nature of biodiversity itself.
Thank you. Turning to paragraph 47 in terms of the, I think this is your alternative text in terms of policy 33218. Can you be any more specific into Roman numeral 2? It says the ability of proposed offset to demonstrate it can achieve no net loss or preferably net gain. The word preferably is a vague, really.
Okay,
but scientists might have thought they could be choosing something else.
Right. Well, biodiversity offsets is a science-based process. I don't think a lot of social confidence.
But it talks about a preference to who,
why then
preference to whom.
Yeah.
So.
Well, in a decision-making context, that could apply to the decision-makers themselves. The reason why that word is there is because it's drawn straight from the definition of the biodiversity offsets, which itself is the adoption of the international BBOC definition of biodiversity offsets. So that's why it's drawn right across there, and not for any other reason. But no net loss is the, that's the threshold for a biodiversity offset in terms of its goal. But if it goes more than that, and that's down to choice, then it's more or greater significance of biodiversity.
My last question is in regards to E on the next page, 14, where it refers to enabling residual emphasis on other vegetation or fauna, when it's other indigenous vegetation, when it means other, what does it refer to relative to, if I've got a site here and I want to do it, is other. Okay. Well, off site, I'm trying to understand what it's meant to achieve.
Okay, there may be a working thing there. D is referring to significant indigenous vegetation. So the policy direction there is stronger, and that's requiring offsets. E is referring to non-significant vegetation. And the policy direction there is enabling, and that recognises the non-significance of the vegetation. And the reason for that is that biodiversity offsets are about biodiversity, which is the variety of life, indigenous vegetation that is not significant as per the criteria is still biodiversity, it's the availability of woods, variety of life. So that's why that's there, and it's also why the policy direction is different between the two.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
Thank you. I have no further questions.
Thank you.
So lastly, we have Mr. Long to talk about planning.
Thank you. I've got a brief summary here. I have some copies if you want. Are you happy for me to read through the summary now?
Yes.
So I'm Jeff Devon of RMA Plan and Flipway Department of Conservation. And just to confirm, I am authorised to provide this evidence to you today. The Director General submission on Chapter 21 rule was focused on the rule for the control of informal airports located on public conservation lands or on Crown pastoral lands. The submission was generally in support but seeking an exemption for the Department of Conservation operational efficiency. The officers accepted the release sought in the submission, and I agree with the officer's recommendation on this rule. The Director General also sought a significant amount of changes to the provisions in Chapter 33, Indigenous Biodiversity and Ecosystems. This was generally to incorporate amendments sought, such as removing the permitted institute for appearance of ECNAs, to provide better provision for a section of areas identified as significant through settlement proposals. Providing for appearance of ECNAs as a non-compliant activity, and providing for biodiversity oxygen. The changes are largely not accepted by the Council Office's recommendation. Regarding identification of ECNAs, I consider the schedule of ECNAs as a significant step in providing for the protection of these sites in the district plan. I do though consider it to be important to provide for protection of these areas that are determined to be significant through development proposals. The Director General's submission sought some amendments to policies of Chapter 33 regarding enabling the use of biodiversity offsetting. The release sought in that submission largely been fixed by the Office of Recommendations for the exception of definitions both of biodiversity offsets and of known eagle offsets. I consider the inclusion of these definitions is required to provide some clarity in the PDP that over what both these concepts involve. In my evidence, I've discussed a number of submission points around the permit activities, standards and exemptions provided for in the rules of Chapter 33. I am generally in agreement with the Office's recommendation on this aspect of the chapter. The submission has also sought that the clearance of vegetation considered to be significant in terms of Section 60 of the RMA be addressed through application of a non-conforming expediency rule. Separating significant indigenous vegetation out from clearance of indigenous vegetation of a lesser value reflects both the policy direction provided by the proposed district plan Chapter 33 and reflects the national importance of providing for the protection of significant indigenous vegetation under the RMA. And finally, the Director General's submission is generally supportive of the provisions of Chapter 34, which places controls on new planting of a number of tree species with wilding potential. The Department of Conservation has particular interest in controlling the spread of wilding trees in the district, and I support the recommendations of the Office and the amendments to the chapter against appropriate. That's including the proposed non-compliant activities service for radios and pine planting.
Turning to paragraph 5 in your evidence, which includes the identification of SNAs through the development of proposals using the criteria in the policy. If they're identified through a consent process, how are they going to be identified in the plan? What's the idea of how that's going to work?
I'm not proposing that if they're identified through a resource consent application or a development proposal, that they then be included in the plan through some sort of plan change. That's not what we're requiring here, or that they're identified and then the assessment of the impact on that area be carried out.
So it would just rely on the any conditions attached to the resource consent that you'd be relying on for that?
That's right.
And turning to the bit about the biodiversity offsetting, from a planning perspective, is it sufficient enough just to have objectives and policies regarding biodiversity offsetting, but then not having a method within a plan about how it actually is supposed to work?
Well, I guess that's what we're seeking and fleshing out greater detail in the policy itself. And I understand also that the proposed policy here is providing a lot more detail than a lot of the other policies that are currently proposed within the chapter, so it may not fit within the flow or the style of the chapter as proposed. But I think that's the answer to your question, is that the policy as we're proposing is providing that method.
Are you aware of any other councils in the country that have adopted something similar to what the department's put forward in this case?
No, because it's relatively new that they say that the department's been seeking this. I'm aware that similar policies have been proposed in the New Territory Plan for process, but that's not the exercise. Yeah, Dr. Berea has been involved in a few more camps initially than I have.
Did you have any examples?
Yeah, All Community Plan has something very similar, but as yet the plan decision's not out.
Does that have anything where, does it just finish a policy, or does it go through to actually having some rules or assessment criteria or method of how you work it out, included within the plan?
It includes policy and then the schedule, which is also attached to my evidence in this one, which provides more detail around methods, principles, and reference to the offsetting guidance.
Mm-hmm.
Within that, that to me is more than sufficient regarding methods.
We only have to wait till July anyway, so interesting.
Yeah.
Can I just clarify, was that incorporated when the plan was notified, or was that the department's submission or the community plan?
The plan as proposed provided for offsets, but again in a less detailed way. What is now in the decision-making process is the result of extensive caucusing between the council and the department and a range of other submitters that had interest in this offsetting. And what I'm proposing here is drawn similarly from what is in that plan.
Okay.
In the interest of consistency. There's a range of other councils that I've been working with, I can give you a list if you want. We also have Wellington come to us.
Wellington City or
regional?
Sorry, I can't talk to you about that, so see you next year.
So we're at a stage where the several councils of union submitted similarly are all in the decision making process.
Back to you, Mr. DeVale. Is there anything in the proposed regional policy statement regarding specifically referencing biodiversity offsets? And did the department make submissions? And I think we have to wait for September for that one, but yeah.
Right. Yes, there is a specific policy on biodiversity offsets. And the department submitted along similar lines to what's proposed here.
What's the department seeking consistent with the proposed RPS, if that was to remain and came through in the decision?
Sorry, it's my question. What we're seeking here is the plan.
It's not inconsistent with, gives effect to whatever it might be at that point. Would it give effect to that policy in the proposed RPS?
Yes, it
would. Thanks, Mr. DeWalt. I'm just looking at your paragraph 43. This is the bit that I was looking for. In relation to anything else that might need to be included within the plan, in relation to biodiversity offsetting, are you confident that what you've listed out there under paragraph 43 is everything we would need to add into the plan if we were to take this further, or do you think it needs to be broken down and give us some more specificity around methods?
The policy does refer to that schedule that's attached to Dr. Berea's evidence that's referred to in that point D3, which also provides further details on what would be guidance or methods in applying defined biodiversity offset. I'm not sure if you've got a large
question.
I think it's important to note that it's not going to be something that's required in all situations, and I think it's probably going to be applied to every end. Bearing that in mind, the cost of it will be relative to the scale of the activity. I don't think I have an answer for you other than that. It's a matter of discretion in deciding that the resource consent process. And if an applicant sort of fits to provide the biodiversity offset and to get them over the line, essentially they would have to bear that cost. Starting that position and working back with any other relief
or any other decision from you would be appropriate. That would be perhaps constitute parts of being struck out. I just want to discuss that with you because I think there is some opportunities for some simplification as part of the plan. Just by way of context, I've just got a map here that I think I've got a copy of. Very simple map that now that map shows the land that at this point is owned by Glenfield Development Limited, and you can pick out, and that's shown in pink, and you can see the green line showing the extent of the Boss Cove subzone of the rural residential zone, and the light green, it's a typical, the different shades of green you appreciate, but the lighter green that spreads beyond that green line, is also rural residential zone. So you've got a subzone within the rural residential zone. And as I'll explain to you, I think that the need for this distinction on many points is obviously unnecessary. But I would like to make an overall comment here that here, in terms of the overall purpose of the zone and the outcome sort, I don't believe the client, certainly I do not have any opposition to the general principles of what is proposed here being a residential zone with sympathetic to landscape characteristics and promoting extensive indigenous revegetation. It really is just a question of the most efficient planning provisions to achieve that, in my opinion. And if I could, in preparation for this morning, I hadn't originally proposed to circulate anything, but I think it will actually be quicker if I do circulate how I believe this could be redrafted for you. So this is a track change version of the conditions as they were notified. And if I could take you to page 23, the third page of this document, you'll see some red line strike out there. You'll see firstly that I suggested that the objective is unnecessary, and the reason for that, you'll see the next objective down that remains in place, in my opinion, reads very similarly. Now that applies to the wider rural residential zone that I just described to you, that a wider area than the subzone itself. Seems to be some duplication. It's not of great concern except an opportunity to streamline the plan, I believe. Not proposing any change to the subsequent policy, except that I should note that that will naturally be moved to sit below the objective that I believe should be retained for Bosco Human. The subsequent policy, I found, I think it's unnecessary to be struck out because there is, again, below a policy around protecting important views of the lake in the Glen Orchy, Queenstown Road. And to me it is a little confusing because there was a great deal of emphasis on revegetation, etc., and it brings in this concept of open pastoral character. Now, I understand from the administration because of the difficulty how the two are incorporated. I'm happy to go into more detail, but I will keep moving in mind of time frames. I just noted a very minor change to a proposed policy, noting the characteristic of the area might be useful, and I think when it comes to meters, it will help explain why. And lastly, I suggested one more policy. In the Multicoast subzone, ensure that mitigation planning is occurred prior to relay building appearance been within 50 metres of the criminal defence down road. This comes to what I followed, that there are a number of methods that I believe in subsequent part of the zone, which I'll go to now, but I think are necessary in connection to be covered by this overriding policy, according to the other policies. So, if I may, I will take you to page 2211 now. And I'll just run you through the amendments and deletions that I think can be incorporated as an opportunity to streamline the zone and as a streamlined administration of it. I should have explained before an important point actually, that with respect to that Glenshill land that I had shown, coloured in pink, subdivision applications have been approved for all of them. Now, they are some way through getting title for the areas, the stages south of the Northeast Queenstown Road. Beyond their land, there are no other major landowners. And in terms of moving forward, there are extensive conditions of consent that effectively enshrine the southern principles talked about under the operating plan, which have been carried over into the proposed plan. I think that's an important context. There may be subsequent variations, etc., and that's really consent to intensify parts of it because they are well below the density that's provided for. But by and large, the framework has been established by subdivision consents that have been approved by council. And returning to the table, there's the first rule that the first rule I am not proposing the retention of the 6 metre height, nor the setback from the Queenstown Colony North Road, which is an important principle in the zone. I have proposed that the first policy around maintaining a limit on tree heights of 2 metres within certain areas close to the Queenstown Colony North Road can be removed because it does propose some administrative difficulties at times because some parts are more sensitive than others in that area. I think overall such a matter, if it is clearly articulated in the policies as I propose, provides for a more fine-grained application in due course through specific subdivisions, and I think we can have confidence that that will occur given the scrutiny that is provided to us by Queenstown Lakes District Councils, landscape architects, etc. Apart from a minor amendment around the residential density rule, which is an important one, that is an important reason that I would not recommend striking out design for flexibility in the minimum lot size. I propose that that be retained. Now, in terms of the boundary planting rule, 22.5.25, I don't have any problem with the 50 metre building restriction area rule, but the subsequent one, 22.5.25.2, that requires plants within 50 metres of the Glenelg Queenstown Road to be at least 2 metres. Actually creates a contradiction with the previous rule I mentioned, 22.5.3, that limits plants to 2 metres. And this is, as you could imagine, creates some confusion and difficulty in administering and can inadvertently trigger activity statuses. So again, I favour trying to push these issues up to a policy level so that it can be on a case-by-case basis in a rational way. The building setback rule 22.5.26 as proposed enforces an additional internal setback rule than the rural residential zone generally. I don't personally see a justification for that, and I note that there is more flexibility in the minimum lot size and density rules in the zone where you typically do end up with sites smaller than 4,000 square metres. So when very commonly applying for a three-year deferral, so I think it can be struck out without any adverse effects. From this point on, I won't go into too great detail, except I will just reiterate my point around these points, I believe, being covered by current consent and can be covered by a very strong directive, objective, and policy regime, and the same outcome can be achieved more efficiently, in my opinion. I just want to raise one flag with respect to 22.528, and it comes up with subsequent rules too, and I raise this tentatively because it's really a legal matter, and naturally you would receive better advice from others on such matters. But it is my understanding, if I understand correctly, that this may pose a virus issue, this rule. If I read it out, no building shall be erected within an area that has been identified as an undomesticated area. Now, the method under the operative plan was that such matters would be identified in due course as undomesticated. Because of the Plan Change 19 decision around outline development plans and what have you, and the findings of the court on the requirements of stipulating activity statuses clearly within a district plan, as opposed to relying on another document or a consent to determine that activity status. The one big question was that this is actually an appropriate method. And again, my solution would be, in the interests of overcoming any doubt on such issues and simplification, again, I would encourage it to sit at a policy level. That kind of issue, where there is a strong direction to achieve across the zone 75% indigenous vegetation cover, etc.
Well, that raises questions that was in my mind.
Right.
There's a number of terms in here, and that is one of them.
Yeah.
That seem to indicate a structure plan exists, but there is no structure plan in the plan, is it?
That's my understanding. Yeah, no such sort of structure plan.
Right.
And those definitions are on the bottom page. Some of them are 22.5 and 31. And my first observation would be development area and undomesticated area are defined in the subzone. Where that's retained, it may make sense if they were moved to the definition part of the plan. That may not matter too much, but if you were to accept my recommendations generally, I don't think that it would need to be precisely defined. That they would be principles that sit at the higher part of the plan and the duties and policies. And similarly, to finish off, the matters of discretion for restricted discretionary activities. Again, I have no problem with what's proposed in principles. I simply do believe that they are covered by the objectives and policies, or just minor tweaks, they can be covered in the objectives and policies, and therefore I argue that they are unnecessary. And the virtue of a brief of plan would be striking through, I think. And I appreciate I've moved through that extremely quickly, and maybe some time to digest what I've said, but I'm happy to take questions on.
Mr. Wells, are you going to leave at 10 o'clock on Thursday? We have a 10-minute slot there, and it just occurs to us it might be more useful if we have the chance to look through this before we ask you questions.
Okay.
And we have a 10-minute slot available.
Yeah, I think that's a very wise idea.
Okay.
So that was 10 a.m.
10 a.m. on Thursday.
Thursday.
26th.
And that means that we'll take all questions until the end, and give us a chance to.
Great. Okay.
Thank you.
slot. We're prepared to shorten our lunch time, so it's not to disadvantage you, but I can say we've read through your submissions, so you won't need to read them verbatim.
Okay, well, I have put in a summary, but perhaps I'll just hand it up rather than go through it, because I've actually made a number of questions for just a buzzer, so I'd like to go through this.
Well, I did have a question for you, but so if you hang up for something, or maybe if we read that to ourselves.
Yes. And there is just one short additional point that I make in here, which is not addressed in my language,
right,
which is the recognition of infrastructure and the rural design. So other than that, it's just a summary of what's in
we'll read this to ourselves, and that will probably halve the amount of time.
Yes, just to refresh you as to what you're there for.
In your summary on page 5 and also in your table submissions on page 20, is this matter of the landowners that would be affected by the as opposed to the reason, would have been adequately informed. You've mentioned that there's no requirement for QAC to consult them. That's understood. But isn't the real question whether a person whose land may be affected by a submission would understand from the submission itself that that restriction was being proposed?
It's a question, part of your question, given you know that the record.
Well, there was appendix C. But what I'm trying to get to is, having looked at appendix C of the QAC submission, if I was the owner of either Lake Mackay Station or the land north of Stevenson Road, that Ms. Sullivan's supplementary evidence provided on Friday shows that potentially affected, I would not have understood from the submission that my land was affected.
Yes, I think that's the dimension of the river, and if you own land and not permission to use it, or it's very close to the runway, I think you can see to assume that you would. So looking at that, say, I know whether or not it's going to be physical land.
Well, the first thing, appendix C has dimensions, but it doesn't tell us whether they're feet or metres. And in aviation, it's not unusual for feet to be used.
The runway strip is given in meters, so it's probably
The second thing is, the plan attached to Ms. Sullivan's evidence shows that at the northern end, the zone starts about a kilometre north of the end of the sealed runway.
The overlay.
Yes. And it would have, to me, as a simple planner who has done a few airport cases in his time, occur to me that we'd be looking at something with such a large offset from the sealed runway.
Sorry, are you referring to the urethra or the overlay?
The reaper.
The reaper
seems quite
so far beyond the runway.
Well, it commences a similar distance beyond the runway as to its length, so it may be 750 metres at the northern end, so that it goes beyond the Stevenson Road and the Council Road land.
Ms. Sheldon may be able to assist you with that. I understand that the location of the reserve is based on the aviation flight, so either it was a redesigned aviation.
But my original question is, if I was the owner of the land north of Stevenson Road, would I know from the QAC submission that the REPA would be likely to affect me? That claim was not part of it, don't forget.
So the reason, the location of the reason that it was with origin is based on the designation of the fashion by storage by runway and one of the
Would I have got that from the submission?
Well, you would know if your land is subject to the excavation. You would know that.
Which
I appreciate the point you were making. And if you are concerned about the submission,
well, the other question I was going to put to you, it's a legal question, is whether the sort of restrictions that are suggested are appropriate in this area are the sorts of restrictions that should be applied through a notice of requirement rather than through a zoning provision, given the rights of the landowners with respect to land subject to the designation.
That is one possibility. Mr. O'Sullivan was in South Country and could discuss the power of these types of controls increased in other districts and I think.
I didn't ask if it was a possibility, I asked if it was preferable from a landowner's point of view, given the rights they have under a designation compared to the rights of a zoning imposed upon them.
Well, I don't know if it is preferable because I think the basis for the rules is the aviation standards recommendations and also some of the provisions in the FAA, the American Civil Air Force. And the intention is that these activities, Given the risk of locating activity within this area, the perception injury, loss of license, damage to property, given the higher, I'm not sure that any circumstances would be appropriate, which I assume is the result of the designation because they could go to require it. So I mean, think the written approval to try to take these activities. So the prohibition affects the low probability of a high potential impact effect of locating these activities with billions of people in the areas within these areas and just that's more effective than ocean road shoots and aircraft approaching the departure of runway.
Isn't the fundamental difference to a landowner who is subject to a designation as opposed to the zoning so they can require will seek the requiring authority to take their land, whereas as with the zoning, there is no right to compensation. Doesn't that put them in a different position?
There is a right to compensation.
Only if there is no practical use.
And
I've never seen one run successfully.
Ms. Stephen took one to the crash chute and she was in the city.
That is very improbable, isn't it?
I couldn't because this is depending on your theory and probably going to be the staff who would have to speak to anything else.
Okay. Do you have any questions?
As well, in the sense of paragraph 30 people around summary, because that's sort of, am I to understand that from your perspective there isn't an, there's not an issue with fairness or that related to the submitters, to the landowners, rather in terms of the fact that it's just that they missed out on the opportunity through the further submission process.
My submission here is that the Tutor 1 process is the standard consultation and that was the opportunity that the public had to involve the same formulation, and that was the case across the board for any committee. And you were capable without that, but there's no additional obligation to consult. And yes, people have to say, if the landowners have had an opportunity to have their voice heard on this issue and might have chosen to, or in this case have chosen not to submit, but they should submit who the land is affected by the render and take an issue with it. But as I say, if the panel is concerned about prejudice, there are a number of ways in which the issue can be addressed.
In terms of the, this is sort of me clarifying, in terms of the plan that, which showed these areas on it, mine says this didn't include the reefer.
The reefer, that's correct.
And, that is, and that's the part that came in by way of the submission. Right.
QAC submission did have a
fail. Yes. In terms of if it wasn't in there, that under section 176.1b, there's this requirement for the requiring authorities written approval if you're undertaking activities within that area. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in the case for Wanaka Airport, who does that go to?
The council.
The council. Mm-hmm. Has the airport approached the council as the requiring authority in regard to seeking formulating its submission and putting it forward this prohibited activity status?
This is another from the issue of hearing that I understand we've done initial discussions faster than initially not at the time before that because the district plan has been formulated for quite some time. I think it's fair to say that there has been neglected somewhat.
Sorry, I couldn't hear that.
Been neglected somewhat, or it hasn't been focused, probably the way to push it, of the council for some time, and there's been a special agreement between QAC and the council. QAC managed it, but the airport put it on a cost recovery basis, and perhaps there hasn't been the investment in time or focus on appropriate
planning
and
appropriate planning regime for the free report that will be for the government.
So my next question
was if that has occurred, would again, would it, Mr. Sullivan, the best place to answer what the answer?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Sorry, you gave us a lot of material to read, so.
Thank you.
turning probably to 104 of your legal submissions. Referring to the prohibited activity rule to exist, it would need the it needs that the policy to be able to in place to be able to direct that rule to exist. Is that the policy basis in regard to the briefer and how that applies, and we directed to the outcome of having a, as I understand your submission, to have a prohibited activity status, where we've got policies that relate to avoiding structures such as infrastructure and the carbon outlets. What's the difference between if one refers to a prohibited activity status? Why is it different for if we've got one that's directing us to avoid activities in O&Ls?
Sorry, is your question
In one case we seem to have one that's directing us to on the other one we see that it comes to a Why legally are they different? If you've got a void in both policies, then why are we making, if I understand it, previously exemptions for infrastructure, but in the other one we're making, we need to, for the free area, we have to have it, that it was a prohibited activity.
QAC has made, if I understand the question, QAC has made provisions on the higher order provisions in the strategic research chapter in the 4th and 5th also, which seek the avoidance of activities in O&Ls and O&Ls. It's made provisions on those provisions for exactly this reason. So it's endeavouring through its submission to get the appropriate policy framework in place in the higher order chapter, and then its rules in relation to infrastructure or in relation to infrastructure and rural zone flows from those higher order issues and policies, which as I say, QAC has submitted on because it doesn't agree with that what is there in the proposed standards is notified is appropriate for this referendum. So it is consistent on that approach in that regard.
Thank you.
Jonathan has prepared a two-page summary of her exhibit, and thank you for giving the opportunity to lodge to supplement the exhibit.
I think it would be helpful if I saw them to read out there some. Yes, thank you.
Thank you. So,
Plan Change 26 and Plan Change 25, they establish a resource management framework that would protect Queenstown and Monash Airport from the potential reverse sensitivity effects arising from activities such as aircraft noise or accidents locating in close proximity to airports. The associated notices of requirement introduce noise management and monitoring requirements for the respective requiring authorities. They also impose noise mitigation obligations on the requiring authorities for the overall framework was established following a robust public submission and hearing process. Both Plan Change 26 and Plan Change 35 were evaluated against Section 32 and Part 2 of the Resource Management. The framework is also generally consistent with the New Zealand Standard Airport Noise Management and Energy Plan. I therefore consider the proposed inclusion of Plan Change 26 and Plan Change 35 provisions into the TDP without substantive amendment sufficient and the most appropriate order. Regional significant infrastructure. The functional, technical, operation and or safety related requirements of regional significant infrastructure may necessitate the location in outstanding natural landscapes or outstanding natural features. As currently drafted, the assessment matters to these landscape areas may then appropriately constrained, I should say, subject committee. In my opinion, the assessment matters for OEL, ONS, and OCL should recognise that the provision of regional significant infrastructure may be appropriate in some circumstances within sensitive landscape. I therefore recommend the changes to the assessment matters that achieve this. For Wanaka Airport, in accordance with Section 176 of the Act, only QODC is the requiring authority for Wanaka Airport benefits from the aerodrome purpose designation. Other airport users must comply with the provisions of the underlying zone. The rural zone provisions do not currently provide any airport or any airport-related activities at Wanaka Airport. Such activities would require regional consent for a non-complying activity under the current DEP structure. I consider this approach as inefficient and unnecessary provided the activities being proposed are consistent with the aerodrome purpose designation. I therefore provided an alternative planning framework for Wanaka Airport, which provides assistance for activities undertaken by other airport users. I have also identified alternative methods that could achieve the same outcome. And I just note that my supplementary evidence I attended some mixed use zone provisions, they were literally just to demonstrate how they could be incorporated. I made no attempt to rework any of those provisions as you would say, it was just to demonstrate, for example, the that mine was five runway entry section areas for Aretha. So Aretha is an area defined at each end of the runway where land use controls are established to protect the public from the risk of an incident or an aircraft undershooting or overshooting the runway. And in my opinion, it is appropriate to prohibit land use activities to exacerbate damage caused by a runway overshoot or undershoot. Now just if I could touch on a couple of things. Paragraph 5.2 of my evidence check. Draw a couple of minutes to attention. It describes the designation and it sets out the activities that are included inside the designation. And that includes aviation skills and rescue facilities and medical facilities. The definition of airport activities also includes these activities because the definition of airport activities is largely consistent with what's provided for by the designation. By definition, these are technically FN, activities sensitive to aircraft noise. Strictly speaking, they would be prohibited within the OCD. So there would need to be an amendment which isn't included in my provisions that I've provided, but Rule 21.4.2.8 would need to specifically exclude aviation schools and or medical or review facilities to enable those particular activities to occur. Aviation schools are already present at one campus, so it's literally the teaching of flying. and medical rescue facilities. The intention there is provision of like search and rescue to both, so not provision of the facility, medical facility at the airport. It is literally for temporary search and rescue triage like situation. That's the first measure that I need to clarify. Paragraph 5.6 of my evidence refers to the title and talks about leasehold titles. All of the airports have been freehold titles and there are ground leases in place that are not leasehold titles. So we just need to correct that measure. Would you like me to touch on measure that?
Could I go back to your point that you just made in regard to paragraph 5.2 and that the rule where you talk about the aviation school that's already in place, is that in place by way of a resource consent or is there an outline plan lodged for it?
I do not know the specific details for that. I have requested a list from the council of
sorry, and a question, sorry, back to you as well. But I recall in your summary, I thought you said that there were examples of where outline plans for.
Yep. So, if there are numerous examples at my airport where this is the case, there have been hangars established that have used the outline plan process, there have been hangars established that have used the resource consent process. There have been all sorts of things.
Would it be fair to say that there's sufficient doubt about the virus and some of the activities established that some it would be valuable for this plan to include some provision that they were all on a legal footing?
Yes, I'm sure the owners of that those improvements will be happy to see that. We can provide you with a list of examples, but I think it's probably you should be in
I can provide you with an example. There's a resource consent at the moment that has been lodged for a new hangar, and the application has been prepared on the basis that the rule does not meet the setback requirements, and it's only because it doesn't meet the setback requirements of the designation that the applicant has applied for a resource consent. Now, in actuality, they need a resource consent for the entire activity. So, yeah, that's another example. So there's two examples.
And the two notices of requirement that are there for the airport are primarily related to aviation activities and then the safety component that is associated with that. The reefer is not one of them.
The reefer is not included in the notice of requirement.
Specifically, or like, does it appear to have been left out, or does it appear that it was on a reading of the designate the notice of requirement? Designation that it is included?
I didn't get the notice requirement, so I'm not sure the specific reasoning for not including the reader as part of that notice requirement, but I think it's to provide examples here where there are some airports use a dual approach, some airports just use collective control.
I think that the council
merely rolled over the designation and didn't seek any alterations within this plan. Is that?
They have undertaken some modifications to the designation.
But they didn't incorporate the river?
No. There were some modifications just around clarity for the office organisation services. And there have been some modifications to the aerodrome services designation as well.
I think it did say the decision was made not to reduce the reef in the DMR.
Provided in March 2013. I haven't been able to find a copy of that anywhere. Can you provide a copy of that, please?
We just, if we can come back to you on that, we might just need to check the status of it. Yeah. Public?
Well, certainly you've given us an extract from it that has to be public, so I'd like to see what the extract is based on. There may be parts that are not relevant to our consideration, but certainly the bits that are relevant I'd like to see.
The examples of the airports where the river is provided by way of a provision of the plan rather than by rules and zoning of the plan rather than by an NOR, what were they?
Which airports or which plans? Hamilton Airport, which is the White Farms District. That's all. Oh yes, it depended from my supplementary about those examples.
Yep.
So Christchurch, Auckland and White Farms. Now those are just three examples that I have drawn from there. There may be others.
In any of those cases, is that duplicated by an NOR?
Christchurch and Auckland is duplicated. Christchurch International Airport and Auckland International Airport have a NOR as well as land use control. White Farm does not.
Don't know which order they went in, do you? Which order they went in those plans?
Assembly, service stations, dwellings, residential activity, visitor accommodation, hospitals, camping grounds, educational facilities, everything else is restricted discretionary. So it's not a prohibition on all activities in the way that you are suggesting is appropriate at Wanaka.
Yes, that is correct. There's different approaches like this is just an example of a different approach to use one car. It is not just approach in Christchurch.
Well, I'm using the one that only uses the district 10 approach rather than the UNLR. But notice the requirement approach, of course, gives it a different flavour.
Yes, the Christchurch one does have a provision approach as well. It may be a reflection of the aviation advice that was received by different sources. I'm not sure who provided the aviation advice to
further related to that is the land at those examples. Does the land that's covered by the reaper, does that is that private land or is it land that's actually owned by the airport?
In those examples?
Yeah.
I'm not efficient, but I can provide you with that.
Depends on the answer. I don't know. Carrying on with your supplementary evidence to start with, at the reaper, at the both ends of the airport, what activities currently go on there now? Yes.
So at the northwest end, in fact, the boat is just starting to move. So I did develop the watch we were putting in place, relying on that search of EDOF, so provided it's there in the system. There is currently a resource consent that you can just see from the photo for irrigation to the north.
Southeast. Yes, southeast. Yes, southeast. Yes, southeast. Yes, southeast. Yes, southeast.
Yes,
southeast. Yes, southeast. Yes, southeast. Yes, southeast. Yes, southeast. Yes, southeast. Yes, southeast. Yes, southeast. Yes, southeast. Yes, southeast. Yes, southeast. Yes, in terms of the type of activity that you'd be concerned about within a reef?
I do not think that it
needs
to come
into
the
place of catchable
definition
of
building.
Right.
It's not a
building. And it's not a pivot irrigators, those big things, do they require, are they a structure, do they require building consent and therefore a fall into its robust definitions?
There is a, in this district, there is a decision in the Mackenzie district that says that they're not buildable
structures. Oh, and structures, okay.
Can I add a question on the road? I was trying to figure out what area you were referring to in terms of bird strike, and whether or not farming areas such as that, with land being worked and then irrigated, would in fact encourage bird strike.
So I have amended that rule, so I appreciate that it's difficult to measure and quantify. Mm-hmm. Typically, however, irrigation does cause difficulties for some people. I can think of an example where irrigation in conversion to dairy has created an increase in bird strike risk, such that it has increased that particular airport safety level from a low to a high, and they sit at high now. So some of those activities can give rise to bird strike issues.
So the bird strike issue does cover the weather area of some intensive issue. I was just trying to figure out whether or not it just says that the proposed plan and the area designated for the airport, but that also covers the Rupa area. Does the bird strike issue also cover the Rupa? Is that also an issue for the Rupa area? That's what I was trying to clarify.
Yeah, right. So I just thought I'd like to draw you to paragraph 3.12 of my subsequent evidence. So you'll see there that I have revised that rule and I have removed those references to attraction at first. There are other means such as regional plan review that people may need to look to try to control the activity through that, and they do have civil aviation regulations that can shoot birds, but obviously they need to be proactive in the
issues. Just in terms of the southeastern end of one of the airport, are you familiar with that? So the 20 to 30 metre difference in elevation, is that relevant?
I did wonder that, what kind of relevance that had. I know that this recommendation had got headed, so they would have been familiar with the site. And
one presumes so, but you cannot rely on that.
They, in preparing the 2013 report, they did a lot of consultation with neighbours, not on this matter, on the climate equal issue. And so they should be familiar with that. So I'm not an aviation
person,
I want to dive into an area, but I'm not quite here.
Yes, I mean, I just, it's really worth exploring, and the question that follows on bird strike is that irrigation. The third irrigator has been on that land for something like 6 years now, I think. Has there been any issue, bird strike, arising from that irrigator being on?
I asked Ralph Stephen this morning, I was up from lunch, and he said no, they had any particular circumstance given rise to bird strike issues.
So I didn't quite catch, was that years or
no?
No.
Just to clarify, the QAC or the Sullivan is no longer recommending the closure of the bird strike.
Yeah, that's fine. I'm just wondering whether the reaper follows landforms or applies at the same elevation as the runway. That might be a matter of clarification that would be useful to know the answer to. Because if it follows at the same elevation as the runway, then there's effectively no constraint at all on Lake Mackay Station.
Much like Oxford Station surface, is the height of the runway.
Yes, that's right.
And so it's irrigation as well. At a level here at the airport, that you're irrigated probably with penetrating the LED from Oxford Station surface because it's dropped down.
Yes.
I can take that clarification.
Yes, that's right. Now, I imagine that we have several other questions, Mr. Sullivan, and it's one of the few already. So I'm suggesting that we adjourn.